You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
Rap Genius. Like, I got nothing to ever hide, man. That's why if we do an interview, ask me whatever the fuck you want. I'm not hiding nothing, so.
Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This episode, we bring you a conversation with R.A. the Rugged Man. R.A. has had a long and controversial career, making fantastic music and pissing off record companies in equal measure. His time at Jive Records in particular was famously contentious and culminated in the iconic song Every Record Label Sucks Dick. Since those days, he has continued to stay at the forefront of underground hip-hop with his great rapping and incessant touring. We spoke to R.A. at the Rap Genius office in Brooklyn a few days before the release of his most recent album, Legends Never Die. As always on Outside the Lines, we bring you a special form of audio footnotes. Every time you hear this sound,
Rap Genius,
go to rapgenius.com and search for OTL41. There, you'll find a series of annotated interview excerpts that give you audio, video, and information to bring you further outside the lines. Now, here's R.A. the Rugged Man. Before we came here, we were talking about the first time you ever appeared on Rap Genius, which was about a blog post we did about the most graphic, you know, sex skits in all of hip-hop, and you won hands down.
I beat a lot of competition, too. Some of the real grimy, dirty, nasty dudes. The Biggies, the Big Puns, the Eminems, the NWAs. I beat everybody for that number one spot. That was a pretty good... I'm glad that I'm the most depraved, disgusting artist you found. I'm glad.
Yeah, definitely. And you had that one song where you said you were the first white pornographic rhymer. And I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, that's 100% accurate, obviously.
Yeah? Yeah. So who were some of the people who kind of influenced you when sort of writing about sex or doing skits about sex or whatever, other rappers or comedians or...
Well, Just Ice was the first one that he had a record back, I think it was 87, where he said, it's called The Original Gangsta Hip Hop, and he said, this record you're about to hear contains explicit dirty lyrics like fuck, shit, ass, bitch, your mother's dick, and all that shit. Hit it, DMX. And then the dude started beatboxing. He said, I ever fuck the girl, I'm guaranteed to make it. Like, he killed it, yeah. So he was the first. I was like, whoa, that dude's crazy. He's a maniac, you know? So
nice. And right before we came in here, also, you showed me a book you're reading about the Houston family. I know you're a big movie buff. But what makes you different, I think, than a lot of people is that you're a big fan of early movies. Like, you might be the only rapper I know to name drop, like Bugsy Berkeley, W.C. Fields, like that kind of shit.
Wow, yeah, you noticed my lyrics. Yeah, this Rap Genius, you know my lyrics.
Yeah,
dude name drop Bugsy Berkeley. He was one of the best. And W.C. Fields, one of the great comedians in history. And I mean, I go back, you know, I got Lon Chaney references from the silent era, you know. So I got a lot of, you know, Fritz Lang, Dr. Mabuse, silent films. So I love the oldies, man.
How'd you get that deep into film?
I was just, as a kid, I loved films, man. I loved movies. And, you know, sometimes you watch a lot of the Hollywood stuff and you lose a little interest, so you dig a little deeper into, you know. I get real obsessed with shit, like hip-hop, you know. Like, when I came up and checked out the Houdinis and the Run DMCs and the, you know, and then later to the Rakims and all that stuff, But then I wanted to find out about the Cold Crush Brothers and a little bit of the more earlier stuff. So I kind of always dig a little deeper to you know, whatever I get involved with. Boxing, if I like something, I get obsessive over it, you know?
Right. Boxing, obviously, you're a huge, huge fan of as well. I definitely like that boxing freestyle you did was kind of like a history of the sport.
From
I don't even know if Jack Johnson or if you named fighters earlier than that.
I named a lot of early day fighters.
Nice. Who are you checking for now, boxing-wise?
There's a lot of great fights coming up, you know, and it was just the Cuban just beat up Donaire this weekend at Radio City Music Hall. That just happened. Outclassed him. And then you got Austin Trout versus Alvarez coming up. That's a good fight. And there's a lot of good fights happening, man. A lot of the good fighters are fighting each other, and it's a good time for boxing, you know.
Nice. Why do you think you gravitated to boxing? Is it because, like, it's sort of a competitive thing in the way that maybe battling was when you started out, or?
No, I liked boxing before I rapped. Boxing I liked when I was, like, 6 years old, and rapping I started getting real serious about around 11, you know, 11, 12, and boxing, my father taught me a lot of things, and the same reason I liked weapons and, you know, fighting, and my father, you know, was a big fight fan. He used to go, oh, check out this, you know, Larry Holmes, he's the greatest fighter, and check out Sugar Ray Leonard, he's going to beat Roberto Duran, and, you know, he's just, you know, so that's how I got involved with boxing until my father put me onto it, and then I joined boxing and tried to be a boxer and all of that stuff.
You tried to
you know, it's funny, my trainer from when I was around 8 years old, Coach Murphy, he had passed a couple years back, but I haven't seen him in 20 years, 25, something like that. And then when I filmed the People's Champ music video, we went to a boxing gym in Long Island, and it was just coincidence that the guy that owned the gym was Coach Murphy, the son. And I remember Coach Murphy's son being in the, you know, it was Mike Murphy. And I remember him back in the day, young guy. Now he was like an older guy like his dad with the boxing gym out. And it was great. I was like, wow, this is Coach Murphy's gym. Check this out.
You know? Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. You mentioned your father in that last answer. I know that one of your most famous songs, best love songs, Uncommon Valor, was written from his point of view.
Yeah.
Right? Did you, when you were writing that, did you ever kind of have any second thoughts about being that open or writing, you know, his story out or anything?
Man, all my lyrics is open, man. If somebody dies in my life, if somebody is, you know, fucked up or this happens or I'm fucked up, or that's what I do. I write, man. Like I got nothing to ever hide, man. That's why if we do an interview, ask me whatever the fuck you want. I'm not hiding nothing, so... I feel the same way about my music. It's like, you know, hey, man, I'm put on a pedestal to some people. They look up to me. So, like, here, I'm going to give back to you people, you know? Like you know, I'm not a, you know, a superstar celebrity, but I got some real hardcore dedicated people that come to me for some of that openness and that truth. So I try to give them it, you know? Yeah.
Did he ever get to hear that song?
Of course, yeah. And he thought it was, he loved it, he, you know? I couldn't have wrote it without him. I called him up. I, like, interviewed him when I was writing the rhyme. I said, okay, what was the helicopter called? What was this? You know, okay, what region were you in here? And, you know, then I called my stepmother. I said, what were the exact diseases that the children had? The one was microcephalic, and the other one, cerebral palsy. And she said, oh, and Max had cortical blindness. And I, okay, cool. So it was almost like I was doing reporting. I called my stepmother and my father, and after I got off the phone with them, I wrote the rhyme, you know?
Rap Genius.
Another thing you've been very open with is you've been way more open than just about any rapper I can think of when it comes to talking about mental illness, which is something that's often really stigmatized, not specifically in hip-hop, but in society at large, as something like people don't often think about.
Yeah, I don't know why everybody always asks me about that shit. But nah, if somebody, you know why I've been ultra open about it? It's because everyone always asks me, so what am I going to do? You know, but I think that... all you gotta do, you can heal yourself. You can heal your own brain. You can just overpower your own fucking brain. Overpower it. Don't let it keep telling you that things are happening that ain't happening. Don't let it keep telling you that, you know, you should kill yourself or the world is a horrible place. And just get past all the bullshit and heal yourself. You don't need all these drugs and brainwashing and turn the fucking kids into zombies and. Oh, my kid is a little hyper. Let me put him on 10 different drugs when he's 10 years old. All of that shit. That shit is worse for the society than just having a little illness and getting over it, you know? Mm-hmm.
definitely. Going to your career for a minute, I was listening to Razor Gloves today, and on that you talk about not ever being marketed correctly. So I was just curious, like, when you were starting out and, you know, at Jive and all that stuff, what do you think, looking back, what might you have done to kind of, on the marketing side?
Well,
you know what I mean?
You know, they wanted to market me in a comical way where it was horrorcore, bloody axes, blood and guts. And that's, you know, because I got signed, I had a song called Bloody Axe and another song called Rubber Room. And that was, you know, I made those songs in the early 90s. And people said, oh, you know, this is a genre, this is a whole genre, this is a whole movement. And, you know, I didn't want to be marketed in a particular, you know, one, you know, I didn't want to do House of Pain is Irish, R.A. is the loony horror guy. This, you know, like, I just wanted to be an MC.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I could have been marketed correctly as a dope artist with a dope, you know, wild out personality, that would have been good enough, you know?
Yeah. And you say, you even say on one of your tunes that the label didn't, at one point you had a label that didn't even want you to curse.
Oh, when I said they tried to treat me like Heavy D and said I couldn't curse?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, they tried to cut down your curse words. They tried, oh, could you make a clean record? Could you make a couple radio records? Could you do this? And I said, I'm just going to make the music. Whatever I do, I do.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And people forget a lot about the that there was a real strong divide in that era between, like, pop rappers and...
But it was a huge divide. It was like, here's the bullshit pop rappers, here's the hip-hop artists. It wasn't all meshed into one where the pop artists are the same as the rap artists, so the rappers have to make records to appeal to the pop crowd. That's what ruined so many great artists, is that they're so busy trying to chase that pop record and their pop celebrity status that they're not making real music.
Yeah.
So back in the day, you had Vanilla Ice, MC Hammer, Young MC, all that stuff, you know. And Young MC had a couple cute little stories. You know, he wasn't like horrible MC, but, you know, it was more commercial. But then you had the lyricist, the, you know, the wise intelligent from Poor Righteous Teachers and you know, the KRS-One's and the Big Daddy Kane's and the monster MCs that were real MCs. They weren't super... pop stars. They weren't MC Hammer. They were just the dope respected artists that were so respected that they could sell gold or close to platinum off of just being, you know, the dope rappers that they were and having a little bit of fame attached to it, you know, and they were marketed as, yo, the teacher, you know, so Poor Righteous Teachers, I'm not sure if they went gold, but I think they did actually, but if they didn't, they damn well went very close, you know, for a little indie record like that on Profile Records, you know.
So what changed, do you think, that everything just kind of got...
Well, the corporations get involved. So, you know, the more money and money and money and money and money and money get involved with things, you know, it all gets flushed into one toilet bowl.
Right.
You know, that's any culture.
Definitely. I think when... when you were starting out, I know you recorded by, you know, a bunch of labels and all that stuff, and you've definitely done a lot of talking about, you know, those days and being so young and being approached by all these people. But just in passing, in lessons, you talk about being courted by Master P.
Oh, yeah, yeah. When I was at Priority, we were in talks about, you know, Master P taking over, and because Priority didn't know how to break any artists. All they had was No Limit. And everything that No Limit touched went gold.
Right.
So Priority, you know, said, yo, you got to meet R.A. So Master P came through and he was like, yo, you know, we can market you like this, we can market you like that. And then Master P brought me in the studio and I started playing him all my dirty rap videos with all the sex and the shit and the throw up and vomit. He was a little scared of that. He made Romeo leave the room. Like, no, get out the room. So, and that's true. Yeah, Romeo was there. He said, get out the room. So that was just when Priority was trying to see if me and No Limit could do something, and it didn't feel like a right fit, you know?
Yeah. To say the least, yeah. I know some of the great rappers you were talking about, who I know you respect a lot.
Nobody ever asked me about that Master P line. I was surprised, you know.
Because, yeah, no, it's sitting right there in the middle of this.
Nobody ever asked, like, what the fuck were you talking about Master P? You know? But nice. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I was just saying, like, you shout out, like, some on the that you've had sort of a list and a couple songs. You'll mention Kane a lot, I know, and you know, Chuck and Rakim and Kool G Rap as sort of these four icons for you. What do you think you learned from listening to each of those guys?
Learned how to rap. Kool G Rap, you know, you learned how to annihilate a track, multi-syllables, and slaughter, and make every bar, not even every bar, every line, and every word painted a picture in a one or two line sentence. You would paint like 3-4 pictures. I learned that from G Rap. You know, Kane was vocals. You know, Kane had great multi and great, he knew how to annihilate a track, and he had this presence. And, you know, it was, but he had this smooth delivery where I'm the best, so yes, I guess it just, you know, that's from Kane. So, Rakim was how to drop knowledge and lay it down on a track. And also, you know, also the same thing that G-Rap did, you know, that was a lot came from Rakim too, you know, the whole multi, but G-Rap took it like on steroids where he went overboard with it. And Rakim kind of, you know, would just say clever, intelligent rhymes with this incredible vocal delivery. And Chuck is, he's the Martin Luther King of rap, that vocals, the vocals, the nobody can attack the mic with the vocal power of a Chuck D. And that's not something you can learn. Like, I try to be powerful like Chuck with my voice.
Yeah. But I know a lot of people still tried to imitate him when he first broke. You can hear it in a lot of stuff in that era.
It's true. But I never tried to imitate him, but I tried to learn from the way he touched that microphone. Like, the way his voice laid down on track. These rappers today sound like bitches, sound like little girls. This rapper was the epitome of what the fuck a voice should sound like when it's delivered to the microphone on a microphone. Chuck was all vocals. So those four are definitely some of the biggest inspirations in my career. You know? Along with the, you know, the Slick Ricks and Dougie Freshes and so many greats in history.
Yeah.
You know, so many greats. You know, you go into the 90s, the guys like Redman, you know, Redman is one of the most ferocious ever, you know, probably the slept on MC ever because he's ferocious.
I was going to say, people just think of him as a comedian or whatever.
Yeah, he's one of the most ferocious of all time, you know.
Definitely. So one of the things I noticed about your style, like, that you do a lot was, like, you'll have in certain songs, you'll have like a long string where you'll just like rap and rap and rap without pausing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like syllable, just like going. And it's a great effect, you know, it never lasts too long. I don't think it ever really goes like over the top. But I was just curious where that came from. If you learned it from someone or if it was like a battling trick or.
No, that is me just trying to mutilate shit. So like, you know, like I don't know where I learned it from. I don't know what MCs did it before me. I'm sure it's been done. You know, I'm not saying I originated that only, but I don't know if I did it. I have no fucking idea. But I just, you know, sometimes I don't want to let go. You know, I want to keep punching and punching and punching and punching and punching and punching and punching them in the face, you know? Like, I don't want to let it breathe. And it's crazy because when you do those songs live, when you're doing them live, you're like, shit, I wish you would have let it breathe. You know, so I could just take a breath because I don't use no hype man. I use just me.
Right.
You know, other rappers could stop and let somebody say the word. So I'm up there spitting every one of them syllables like, please, breath, hurry up, get to a breath. Oh, I'm out of breath. Okay, attack it again. So you know. Maybe my next album, I'll write with a few more breaths to make my stage shows a little easier, you know? Or I'll bring a hype man on stage.
Right, right. So you had some funny label mates in your first sort of incarnation with Jive. I know that at a certain point they started bringing on pop acts, Backstreet Boys and
I was
all that
signed
kind of stuff.
to Backstreet Boys and signed to the same label with Backstreet Boys and NSYNC and Britney Spears and Aaliyah and R. Kelly and Shaquille O'Neal.
Shaquille O'Neal, I was going to say, Shaq Fu. Did you ever meet him?
My producer, Mark Niles, who's with my producer since I'm 16, he did most of Night of the Bloody Apes and a lot of American Lowlife and quite a few tracks on Die Rugged Man Die, and he did one of the songs that's going to be one of the singles on Legends Never Die. He's been in my corner for a lot of years, and me and him got in a fight after I left Jive. He stayed with Jive, and he produced Shaquille O'Neal, a couple joints for him, and the Insane Clown Posse. He was producing all of those fucking guys. And Jive, I was blackballed and hated, and this dude went to them to fuck with them because they were writing checks, you know?
Yeah.
So we wasn't cool for like 5 years, me and Niles. If you're listening, Niles, you fucking scumbag. we have a love-hate relationship, me and Niles, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was curious about something. We were talking about, movies a little while back, and specifically about TV and movies and stuff. You have that line where you say, I grew up worshiping Charles Bronson, John Rambo, and Chuck Norris.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was just curious, like, how you think seeing those kinds of figures on TV and the movies and stuff growing up, how you think that shaped your personality?
Well, of course it shapes your personality. I think it gives the children a little masculinity in their life where they could be men. They don't have to be ashamed of being men. You could defend yourself and fight for yourself. And now I think men are little girls. Teach them to be feminine. Teach them to be soft. Teach them to be womanly men. Teach them to wear girls' clothes. Teach them to be bitches. I think they want to, soft and sensitized fucking men. So I think growing up on the Rambos and the Chuck Norrises was good for a kid, So.
Nice. You also say in one of your new songs you were lacking in discipline as a kid. What was your childhood like?
Well, my father was wild, and he'd be out there 1 month, he'd, be out there fighting and getting arrested and bar fights and getting drunk with women and, crashing into our front lawn with my mother in the house, and he's got like the teenage girl in the back of the car, he was a wild man and a great, great, great man. But and then another time, then he became Prince Omar, the Black Angel,
Wait, you'll have to explain that one.
Yeah, he became a preacher, and he sent away in the National Choir for a priest collar, and he started marrying people and going door to door and like, I'll save you, and like, he became very, he got bit by that Jesus bug, man, and Jesus sometimes kicks you in the ass, so they say, oh, he has some problems, so they had him locked up a couple of times, and to kind of get his brain straight. And, so I got the single mother. She was European from Germany, and my father's not always there when I was younger. And, I do what I want. I'm used to run around the streets and act a little wild, So, yeah,
All right. So you've the new, at the time we're talking now, your new album's coming out in just a couple of days, right?
Yeah, yeah. Legends Never Die is in stores April 30th. And I need everybody to support it. Put up, pictures on your damn internet. Just spread the word, man. Just Legends Never Die. It's an independent cause, so we'll one little small operation, but the music is huge. So everybody gotta support it, man. It's really some of the best work of my career, and any hip hop fan that hears it, real hip hop fan, they're gonna really appreciate it.
Yeah, I know you got a lot of some notable guest appearances on that.
Yeah, but even if there was no guest appearances on it, I'd take all the guest appearances off. I got, 17 or 18 songs. I got 5 songs with appearances on it. So even if it was only 11, 12 RA songs with no guest appearances, it's still an album I'm very proud of. But I love my guest appearances, too. Yeah. My song with Talib Kweli is getting a great response because that's already leaked. And the next one the world is going to hear is the Tech N9ne Chris Calico record, and that's a real big one. And Brother Ali and Master Ace, the young boy Hobson, man, he came real correct on his joint. And Vinny Paz, and some Dot X. We got a real good album, real great album that I'm proud of. You know?
That's incredible. On the first song from that album, The People's Champ, you had this line on it that really caught my ear. I was just curious to maybe hear your thoughts on it, where you say, "I'm the white boy version of Nat Turner."
Yeah. Well, when I wrote that line, I said, you know, this don't even make no sense. That's the funniest fucking kick you in the dick line ever. Because how the fuck is anybody the white boy version of Nat Turner? So it was, that was me being RA, being comical. You know, I'm not a black militant escaped slave killing white folks. It's just a funny line. I thought it was a very funny line, you know.
So, yeah. But you have, in a lot of ways, in a lot of your work, like, been...
pro-black somehow?
Been pro-black. Been,
yeah,
like,
it's weird, right?
Right?
And I'm also, like the most pro-black rapper.
Yeah, and also just, like, aware of, like, how racism works. You know what I mean? Of, like, I don't know, for lack of a better word, like, institutional racism. There's larger forces. It's not just, like, someone saying, I don't like you because you look like X. I feel like that kind of seeps into your work a lot.
Okay.
And I don't know. I guess I was just curious, like, how these sort of big picture things came about. If you think it was just from being in hip hop, or
well, like I said, when I was a kid, I was raised. You know, when I started rapping, I was raised on that era where it was the X Clan and you know the 5% Nation and you know some of my best friends that I grew up with that all of a sudden. They were being told that, you know, the white man's the devil, and I come from the Caucasus Mountains, and I'm you know, I got leprosy, and you know this and that. And one of my good friends, Marcus, he had like the damn, you know, Kid and Play Gumby type of shit, and you know, we grew up together. All of a sudden, he was going to the mosque every day, and he said, I had a nephew that was sick. My nephew passed away at 6 months old. And me and this kid Marcus, he was older and bigger than me, but we almost came to blows because he said, "Oh no, that baby, that baby's cursed, man. It's a white baby. It's cursed." You know, we were teenagers, 15. I said, "What do you mean a baby's cursed?" He said, "You know." I said, "So you're telling me that little young baby went to hell because it was born white?" He said, "How you know your sister didn't feed it a piece of bacon or something?" I said, "Yo, that's so stupid." No, but that, you know, we were young idiot kids,
yeah.
You know.
So, yeah.
You know. And it's funny, one time I was in Marcus' house and his father was put my head on the couch and he said, "Oh, you know, have him put a towel there." They put a towel down because it said white folks, the greasy, you know, there's grease in our hair that isn't on like black people's hair, so like white folks have like this weird grease shit on their hair. So, okay, go ahead, put the towel on the pillow. So I put my head on the towel, I don't care, you know?
So just being around that seeps in some ways.
No, but yeah. Okay, then you get the black side of it. But then also, being a kid, my sister would roll with the pagans and the Hells Angels and those bikers, you know, and some of those bikers would be like, have motorcycles with swastikas on their goddamn bicycles and like, you know, I hate, you know, N-words and blah, blah. Yeah, I'll kill a Puerto Rican, you know, like the racist, crazy white, you know, biker dudes. And then you had the god bodies that you know, thought that I was diseased. And, you know, you had all racism coming from all angles. And it was all wild, you know. I didn't know it affected me as a kid, but then as a grown-up, when I look back, I got to laugh at it. Like, oh, my God, everybody's retarded. But at the time, I just thought it was regular. Like, that's how people, you know, the bikers are weird, Nazi, racist fucks. These dudes think, you know, white folks are Caucasus Mountain cavemen, cave-dwelling devils and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, like the X-Clan, they're silly polar bear, you know, all of that stuff. I was like, yeah, I'm a polar bear. What?
Nice. And there's an artist you rap about knowing about who I think a lot of people wouldn't necessarily associate with R.A. the Rugged Man, who you knew early in her career, and it's Nora Jones.
Oh, I had one line. I don't know. You know,
yeah,
I said the one thing. Now, what was with Nora was there was a boy who had a talent agency. His name was Phil Cassess. So he used to manage, but he used to do jingles for Nora and get her work. And if she'd book like a little lounge, he would, you know, help her, you know, get the lounge thing. And it'd be like Nora would be there setting up and like taking it all serious. I'm like, yo, there's like fucking 12 people here. What the fuck is she taking so serious? Like, no, the mic's not good enough, blah, blah, blah. Who the fuck this bitch thinks she is? You know, no, I'm just kidding. But no, but she's a real sweet girl, sweet, yeah, sweet girl. And then, you know, Phil had said, oh, you know, you saw Nora was on Letterman last night. I said, Nora, the girl from the fucking lounge? The girl you do those little stupid events for? Yeah, yeah. So she put in, she paid her dues and came from the bottom. Yeah. I mean, she didn't come from the bottom, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But from the going to Manhattan and trying to do little little singer-songwriting circles to really making something beautiful for herself. And she's a sweet girl because I had seen her a few years back after she blew up big. And she was at the Christmas markets, you know, in Union Square.
Yeah.
Is that Union Square? Yeah,
yeah,
14.
Yeah, Union Square.
Union Square. And I seen her there, and I was with my little sister. I said, hey, this is my little sister, Nikki. Hey, Nora, how you doing? And she was sweet as hell. And then she's like, oh, how you doing? How you been? Okay, everything's sweet. Everything's cool, you know. So, but then my sister's like, she wasn't famous. Nobody recognized her. I'm like, that girl, you know, my little sister was a kid, you know.
Yeah.
Like, if she was famous, how could she thought, like, you know, famous people walk down the streets and everybody, you know, oh, my God. But, you know, I said, no, she had a hat on. She was in disguise, you know. She wasn't in disguise, but she, you know, had a little winter clothes on.
Yeah.
And I explained to her, I said, no, that girl that you just met sold more than all the people you watch on MTV.
Definitely. So I guess one other quick thing that I thought was kind of funny. You had one of your best known songs, Stanley Kubrick, basically remade by The Alchemist.
Yeah, that was weird. Alchemist.
How did you feel when you first heard that? Like, do you remember the moment of first hearing?
Alchemist played
me
the beat before he sold it. He said, "Oh, yo, check out this beat I made." He played it for me at his little apartment. Evidence had come over the next day or whatever, and they were both on the come up, you know.
Yeah.
And he played me the beat and said, "Yo, I heard your song on Stretch Armstrong," and I got inspired. I said, "Oh shit, that sound like the same thing." Then I guess Royce heard it and bought it or whatever, and it became, you know, it had some good PR behind it, and it did well, and they sold it to some video games. And
nice.
So I was just kidding around with
it. No, I know. I didn't think
when
you
I
were
When I said, yo,
seriously,
Al, you're
like,
my little buddy,
yeah,
stole that beat, you know, I was just making a little joke. The real producer of that beat is Capital, the crime lord, mm-hmm, out in Long Island, and he was a big rapper, one of the better rappers in my neighborhood growing up. He rapped on a little white Italian and Puerto Rican kid. He rapped on Biz Markie's album. His name's Capital T. He rapped on I Need a Haircut. He rapped on Diamond Shell's album. He was a really, really good rapper producer, you know.
Yeah. Rap Genius.
Who else from that Long Island scene do you feel people have kind of forgotten about or never quite got the recognition that they deserved?
There was a lot of rappers. You know, I mean, Granddaddy IU's over in Hempstead.
I love him. He's been a guest on the show.
Yeah, yeah. He's in Hempstead. And, you know, I was just with Rock Marciano last night. And you know, there was a lot of great rappers from my way. Even you go, you know, K-Solo put out two records on Atlantic Records. But I think historically he's underrated as a lyricist. I think he's actually a really complex storyteller.
Right. And people, unfortunately, at most remember one tune.
Yeah, like some of the spelling of this and that.
Yeah,
but you know, when he came back with Redman a couple of years later,
yeah,
with that one joint, the big song where they sampled the Just Ice beat. K-Solo is a super lyricist, man, in his day, man. And some of his storytelling, some of the best storyteller ever laid down. You know, The Fugitive and Tales from the Crack Side and some of those stories that he really went in deep on, they were pretty great.
And one thing that I couldn't help but wonder, listening to your catalog a little bit, you mentioned Charlie Manson a lot, and I was wondering, is it like
I did
you name drop him a couple times, yeah?
And
I was just wondering if it was like just shorthand for like crazy, or if you had any kind of fascination.
When did I mention Charlie Manson? I don't remember.
I honestly forget the tunes, but
yeah,
when I was listening through today.
Oh, I think you're talking about Crazy Man because the
yeah.
song I called him a pussy. I said Charles
oh, right.
Manson's
you're comparing
a pussy.
Yourself favorably to him.
I said Charles yeah. Manson's a pussy. Charles Manson's a pussy. A wannabe musician. I piss on that hippie.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. I was shitting on Charles, you know, little weasel. Did I ever use him again, man?
It might have been one other time. I don't remember. And
I was wondering, because, you know, obviously Stanley Kubrick was on Sound Bombing, and, you know, you had an affiliation with Ruckus. Like, how did you fit in with that whole sort of Ruckus crew during their heyday?
Well, I at the time was the most famous one that they knew, you know, because I was the little veteran, and then Talib, Mos Def, all those guys were kind of on the come up. So they always like, yo, Ari the Rugged Man, I know who that is. You know, like I was like the older cat. That's crazy, right?
Yeah.
But so they just hit me up, and I didn't fit in very well, obviously. You know, I was more rah rah rowdy crazy, and their other stuff was more like peaceful, spiritual. You know, I guess Thurston Howell III fit in there with me, but like we didn't really fit the whole scene of a Ruckus. Ruckus was more, you know, like that Afrocentric type, even though it was run by a bunch of like rich hippie kids, you know.
Right, including Rupert Murdoch's son.
Yeah, Rupert Murdoch's. That was Rupert Murdoch money. I said that on a damn, I did a remix, MF Doom remix, me and Doom. And I said, the devils from underground to, I forgot what I said, the devils from mainstream to underground hip hop or something like that.
Right.
I said, Jive supported apartheid and Ruckus was Rupert Murdoch, you know?
Yeah.
Because, you know, Jive was a South African owned label and had parts of the whole apartheid thing, supposedly, you know? So.
Rap Genius.
Well, so tell me about plans, obviously, of the record coming out. What's, you know, what's coming up to support it? Are you doing any shows or anything?
Well, yeah. I stay on the road. You know?
Yeah.
I'm gonna try my fucking hardest to do 200 shows this year. I want to be on the road nonstop. Like, I don't want to not be on the road. So that's my main thing. And then I just want to be on the road and promote and promote and promote and promote and then come and work on a new album, you know. And then, you know, I'm going to drop some good, really, really good videos. And
I'd imagine as a film buff, you probably have lots of ideas for...
Yeah, I got tons of ideas. The only thing is budgets, you know? Like, you have all these huge ideas in your head, and then when you're like, well, we have, you know, $1,200 to shoot the whole video, so you have to be very creative with the productions, you know? But a couple of videos I spent a couple more on, you know, $3,900, $4,100. Spent a couple dollars on a couple of these videos, you know? For me, those are big budget now, you know? So
yeah.
They're going to look big. Like, I did one that looks like it cost $50,000 or something, you know.
I guess the one final thing was, like, you were talking about, you know, you were at Jive, right, and all these sort of pop artists were there, and you sort of got to see that almost from the inside, you know. Do you view like, not having that kind of, like, and you were talking about the pop rappers of when you were starting out, do you feel like you not having that kind of, like, pop crossover success has been like a blessing or a frustration or sometimes both?
It's been a blessing, a big blessing, because, you know, all the rappers that I dealt with that did the big crossover pop thing, they lasted a year or two, then when their shine fell off, they were losers, you know. The ones that have the longest reign are the dudes that, you know, make good music, keep making good music, and don't make a crossover song or two to fucking, you know. I'm glad everything, the way everything went is exactly how it should have went, and I'm blessed, you know.
Yeah. So, yeah. Excellent. And you've obviously, you know, you've worked with a ton of pretty much every notable rapper, I would say, during your time out, just about.
Who and I'm was still doing it. I'm still doing it, you know.
Yeah, which is crazy. Who is someone that you've worked with who's really surprised you in whatever way? Maybe they were, you know, either more talented or funnier or more standoffish or friendlier.
Talib Kweli, I knew him for years. And, you know, I always knew he was a good lyricist. But, you know, I was like, you know, is he going to be able to hang with me on this record? And he hung big time. His verse is fucking massive. So I was there. He was right there. Like, it's arguable. Some people say I got the better verse. Some people say he has a better verse. But we hung. Like, it was like, I was like, yo, Talib. When I got his verse back, I was so excited. I said, yo, Talib obliterated. This is incredible. Like, I was so excited. Yeah. Like, I like it when I send some shit in. Like, and sometimes people send me verses, and I'm like, I kind of like, you know, I kind of
killed them on this. I wish they would have. I want to almost send the verse back and tell them to go harder, you know?
Yeah.
And so I like it when like a verse come back to me and I'm like, wow, this dude went in, you know? So, so that Talib one was a nice surprise. And I thought it was amazing. And I think this whole song's amazing. And then, who else did I work with that just surprised me? That's just very recent. That's why I'm thinking of that one. You know, that's why I'm like, you know.
And I do have to ask though, how did you get Big to be so filthy on record?
Well, because what happened when Big showed up at the studio, I had already had my lyrics laid down. He took a car, you know, out to Long Island.
For our listeners who don't know, that his great duet with Big is called Cunt Renaissance.
Yeah, it's really foul and disgusting, and I purposely made it so foul and disgusting to piss off the record label. Because they wanted me to make a commercial song with Biggie. They wanted me to make something that they could get played all over the fucking radio nationwide. And I said, okay, I'll do that for you. And I tried to, I said, what's the most disgusting, disgusting lyric I could think of? And it was right around the time when Lorena Bobbitt chopped off the husband's dick,
right.
You know, and got away with it.
Yeah.
And I said, yo, man, imagine like you ripped like some bitch's cunt out with a spoon. That you'd go to jail for life. How the fuck she's allowed to cut off a dick? And do 3 months. That's crazy. So I said, rip a cunt out with a spoon. I said, oh, shit. You can't get any more disgusting than that. I rip your cunt out with spoons. Yes. So
So when Big walked in, he didn't know the concept.
Well,
Big
already had the beat.
Oh, he had the beat.
And he already wrote something, and he knew it was a sex record. But then when he said, you know, I know from fucking with you, it's going to be some wild shit, you know. But then when he showed up, he's like, yo, your label's letting you say that? I said, yeah. He's like, all right, give me a couple. Let me rewrite my shit and get a little crazier. So he smoked a little blunt and he you know, sat there for a couple hours and wrote his shit and then went in the booth.
I heard you talk about your relationship with him a little bit with Reggie on the Combat Jack show. And what was so interesting to me was you talked about him like a person. And you said, you know, I didn't know he was going to be the like hip hop icon of icons. He was just a good rapper who
He is a person. Like, you know, people put all of us on pedestals like we're like super beings, you know. Biggie was just some kid that rapped in the neighborhood, you know. And I mean it's a blessing the impact he made on society, man. I'm proud of the brother. I'm not saying he shouldn't be that, but I'm just, you know, these are people in your world. That's like, imagine this dude over here. What's your name again? Gabriel?
Gavin.
If Gavin all of a sudden is the fucking icon, you work with Gavin and Gavin's your boy, and all of a sudden Gavin's the biggest respected human being over, you'd be like, what the fuck is Gavin? Like, you don't think like regular, you know, you don't think of regular people like there's some above where the whole world is going to bow down to them. But, you know, that's why it was unbelievable seeing this dude Biggie that I knew. And we were friends, and he'd call my house at 3 a.m. and, you know, we'd drive around my car and tell store jokes and play records for each other. And, you know, all of a sudden he's this one of the most iconic, you know, people in the history of hip hop to society.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable to me. I love it, but it's, you know, he's a regular ass dude.
Yeah.
But I mean, I understand it because Rakim is a regular dude. He's a human being. But when I see him, I get starstruck, and I'm in awe. Like, oh, my God, it's Rakim. So I understand where people get starstruck over the image and the thought of Biggie, you know. But I was with him in the battlefield. So, he looked like a regular person to me. But, you know, dudes that came up before me that I grew up looking up to, I understand it because I do this. Oh, that's Rakim. Oh, my God, it's Rakim. When I see Rakim, I try to act cool, and I can't. I'm like, hey, how are you? Hey, Ra, hey. And he's like, hey, what's up, R.A.? And we talk, and it's just like, and I'm such a nerd trying not to be a nerd. Like, yo, you know, and remember when you said this lyric? You were amazing. I mean, stop kissing this dude's ass. Yo, stop. You know, like, so I understand the idea of worship of a human. But, you know, on the bottom line is they are all just regular-ass human beings. Went to grade school. You know, cried for his mom,
yeah.
You know, got in fights in school, you know, they're regular ass people, you know, so. Yeah.
Well, that's incredible. So thank you so much for coming by. Legends Never Die, out April 30th.
Yeah, April 30th. Please, everybody, support. I mean, don't go just stealing the goddamn album. Just go pick it up and support, because if you support, then artists like myself could continue to make more music, because I like making my music competitive, and I like having it on a big board and having a nice mix and taking my time recording it nicely. Yeah. And making it sound, you know, get it mastered by a legitimate, you know, cat that masters records. I want all my shit to sound great. So, the money I make on my goddamn music, I usually put it right back into the music. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, there aren't nearly as many studios now as there were.
Because everybody got a house studio, and nobody cares about the quality of music, so they just, like, do it in their house and make some idiot mix, and I'm never going to put out music like that. I'm not going to do something out of my house and just, you know, have it sound like a mixtape, and all my records are going to sound like real records, you know. So
that's incredible. We look forward to hearing it, and thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you, Rap Genius.
That was our conversation with R.A. the Rugged Man. If you enjoyed what you heard, please find and visit us on iTunes. From there, you can subscribe so that you never miss an episode. You can also leave us a review. The more positive reviews we get, the better chance we'll be able to keep on getting incredible guests like R.A. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius was created and written by Sean Sotaro, a.k.a. Same Old Sean.
Put on a pedestal to some people. They look up to me.
The show was produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
You can't get any more disgusting than that.
This interview was recorded by Gavin Matthews.
The Black Angel.
Our music is by Psionic.
Punching and punching and punching and punching and punching and punching and punching them in the face, you know?
And the upcoming OutsideTheLinesPodcast.com was created by Paul Dice.
That's the funniest fucking kick you in the dick line ever.
Make sure to follow us on Twitter at OTL_podcast and like us on Facebook at Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. Join us in 2 weeks when we bring you a conversation with writer Michael P. Jeffries, author of Paint the White House Black. We talk to Jeffries about hip-hop, race relations, the president, and being biracial in today's world. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Outside the Lines with Rap Genius.
I just talked.
Yeah, yeah, just, you know. Well, we try to make it feel as much like a conversation as possible, you know? Oh, really? Okay, well, so we're going to talk for 21 hours until the tape runs out. I hope you're cool. You don't have any plans for the next little bit.
As long as I'm the only one who you tweet about for the next 10 months.